This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Tuesday, 13th of April, 2021. And I think it's a pretty important day for markets. We've kind of lost a lot of momentum and energy in some ways as we started the week. I think the market's looking to maybe today's CPI, maybe next move for U.S. Treasuries. Not sure, but we'll have lots to get through today. And I'll be hosting an FX webinar, as I mentioned yesterday. I'll be doing that later today. You can find the sign up if you go to webinars.saxo. A replay will be available tomorrow. Or soon thereafter, if you do miss the webinar. Peter, we have, we talked a little bit of it yesterday about some of the European stocks losing momentum after quite a run. And I've sort of cobbled together some rough technical situation for the Euro Stoxx 50. I think it's kind of interesting because what we've seen is kind of an acceleration higher and arguably somewhat looking like an ascending wedge where we almost sort of have seen a semi blow off top here. The horizontal line I drew on the chart on slide 3 showing that former major top, and it was sort of a double top, that former level. So just wondering if it's gotten to be too much too fast and it's time for consolidation, or am I just being a bit too pessimistic here? What's your take on what the market's looking for and how nervous it is around anything? It seems like it's fairly complacent if we look at something like the VIX in the US, et cetera.
Well, I think in Europe, you've put up the cash index, and I think that's actually making European equities a courtesy here, because if you take the futures on the Stoxx 50, you actually have had three straight sessions now with lower highs. It looks technically even worse than what you have up there on slide 3 here, John. I think Europe is really having a risk premium being built in because of the political situation, the slowdown or the slow rollout of vaccinations. You have a situation in Hungary that is maybe not developing as good as you could expect. They've used the Sputnik instead of some of the other vaccines. An interesting story developing there. You have, I think, real concerns of among global investors about what is the potency of the fiscal response in Europe. We know it's there in the UK and the US, but what about the continent here? I think that's a real risk. But as I've said before, Europe is very cheap. It's a pro-cyclical economy. It should do well under inflationary conditions. But elsewhere in equities, I think we have a lot of interesting things going on. On slide 4, India, our GDR basket was down almost 6% yesterday. And it's actually because India is now posting yet again a new record on new daily cases. Death numbers are rising. And the rupee was also under massive pressure yesterday. And there's real concern now in India. And it was one of the best performing parts of the equity market until just recently. So this is definitely a story that is worth following because of its implications for the emerging markets. It's one of the big four components of the MSCI Emerging Markets Index. As you can see as well, mega caps. And we've highlighted this before. It's very high quality. It's really something that is worth having in mind as we approach this inflationary mind, but also maybe a little bit more uncertainty than mega caps as a flight to safety. Also, final, before I let this go, please watch the SPAC space, because the SEC is now introducing a new accounting rule. So a lot of these SPACs in the US, they come with a lot of warrants to the early investors, and they are right now treated as equity. So it doesn't look like there's a lot of downside risk for the next phase investors when the SPAC has done an acquisition. But all these warrants, they obviously dilute when the deal is done. And the SEC is saying that this should be treated as liabilities, and that could really take some steam out of this market.
All right. Yeah, the risk there on that front, and then on the COVID front as well. Even in the U.S., there's the risk of this multi-speed recovery or emergence from lockdown, as Michigan is having troubles getting ahead of their situation, despite a fairly high vaccine rollout level there. I'll tell you, there's a lot of anticipation around treasuries this week, and we've kind of gone quiet there after the initial surge in yields. The auctions yesterday, you're indicating, weren't really that particularly strong. They didn't generate a lot of headlines, but what's your take there? And we have a 30-year today.
Yes, John. If you guys go on slide five, on the top left, you see that I put a table where I look at the bid to cover and indirect bids for 3 years, 10 years, and 30 years bonds. And if you look at the results from yesterday, both the bid to cover and indirect bids for both the 3 years and the 10 years auction have been below the 1 year average. So what is that telling us? Well, it's telling us that although the auction was good and it didn't have any hiccup, the thing is that sentiment continued to be bearish. And this goes in direct contrast to what we have seen last week. If you look at the graph on the bottom left, then you see that at the end of last week, speculators turned net long on U.S. Treasury futures. And if sentiment was that bullish, we would have seen a certain improvement in bidding metrics that we didn't see at yesterday's auction. So today, for the 30-year bonds, anything could happen. And the key is looking at whether the bid to cover and direct bids for these bonds are well below the one-year average. And my guess is that they will be, because if we look at outflows in TLT, which is an ETF for ultra-long treasury maturities, we see that outflows have been the highest since 2000. So definitely bearish sentiments on the long part of the yield curve.
Yeah, and then one of the bond markets I failed to understand a little bit as we work further into the year is the UK gilt market and the yields there, the nominal yields there, certainly relative to the US. And I wonder at the inflation risk in the UK as well. And just as a reminder of where we are in terms of the structural twin deficit in the UK, we got a number in this morning, the latest February trade balance, so-called visible trade balance out of the UK. You can see that on slide six here at minus 16 billion for a month. This is just terrible stuff for for the idea that we're going to reach some sort of balance. And I think it really does present or sort of bolster my argument that any sterling recovery is going to have a fairly low ceiling as long as we're posting deficits on this scale. Of course, there are some capital inflows coming in to invest in the UK as we're clear of the residual Brexit uncertainty to a certain degree, at least. But this is something that bears watching in the future. And then on that note, you've got the 50-year gilts chart here on slide seven. Is that that's the nominal yield on a 50-year is at 1.1%? Am I reading that correctly? I'll say it on slide seven.
Yes, John. So if you buy 50 years gilts, you will get 1.1% in yield. I know it sounds a little bit ridiculous, but what is more ridiculous is that apparently there is huge demand for these ultra long maturities. And this is why the treasuries are looking to issue to reopen the 2071 gilts today and also again in June. Apparently, dealers in the UK have been reluctant to sell long-term debt to the Bank of England under the quantitative easing program because they are afraid to run out of long-term gilts to sell to their investors. So demand is strong, and what we are looking at today's issuance is whether this demand is going to tighten yields on the long part of the yield curve that could have also a positive impact on the 10-year yields, which have been rising quite a bit since the beginning of the year. Actually, they quadrupled the yield since the beginning of the year. So definitely important for the overall sentiment in the yield curve.
All right, fascinating stuff. It only seems to make sense, one would think, in a deflationary environment, and that's not what all the concerns are around here. But looking forward, we have this earnings season kicking into gear, and you've got some perspectives, Peter, on equity valuations. And of course, key to that will be these incoming earnings. But take us through what you're looking at here on slide eight. One of your looks to me like a slightly nerdy chart, Peter. What's going on?
It's very simple actually, in the sense that we know the biggest determinant of future returns, one of those is what basically you pay for the asset. So the higher you pay, the higher price you pay, the worse your return is, and that's what you see on the right hand side of slide 8, right? So you see a very tight, almost linear relationship between those things, and right now we are around 2 standard deviations expensive on trailing measures. We're using 7 different valuation metrics. As I indicated yesterday in an internal note, I know these are trailing, so they are probably a little bit inflated because of what happened over the past year. So, and we have very high expectations for what will happen. But regardless, it reflects very high expectations. If I had used a chart using forward expectations, 12 or 24 months, then you would also have seen that equities on an absolute basis, that means measured against itself, is beginning to be extremely, not extremely, that sounds very aggressive, but it gets very expensive, at least very close to par with what we saw in 2000. So it eats into your future expected returns, and it's something I'm going to be writing more about later today.
Just to put it into layman's terms, if I'm hearing you correctly, looking at your chart, if I do a visual linear regression there, it looks like, and your red shaded bar is the negative 2 standard deviation level, you should expect a 10-year return of something like minus, let's call it 2 to 3% over the next 10 years, yeah?
Yeah, the exactly. So the prediction interval is quite wide. So, but there is the probability, I would phrase it that way, is definitely skewed in the direction of a high expectation for a negative return, as you say. And keep in mind, these are real rate returns. So they are minus inflation. And if you're right about our inflation call and our calls on globalization and global supply chains, etc., and MMT and fiscal, if we're right about that here at Saxo, then potentially we could have equities not posting positive real rate returns over the next 10 years from current levels.
But a very important point, though, as you mentioned, with inflation and real rates, you could have a nominally something that looks slightly flat to slightly higher, but it is the real return is all important.
Exactly.
All right. And we had a listener question about free cash flow, I suppose it was. And on your next slide there.
Yeah, exactly. I just want to clarify, because if you have one listener that is have been having thoughts about this, probably others too. And the question was basically that what the free cash flow on NASDAQ 100 was, and was it really 4.5%, 5%? And the 4.5% to 5% free cash flow is something you can see in the MSCI world. NASDAQ, and we've put up this chart many times before, is trading at 2.8% free cash flow yield versus 1.2% yield to worst for the global investment grade corporate bonds. So that's your spread. It's much tighter than it has been before. Has been a little bit tighter, but it is getting tight there. And there are two, discussion points or questions to us. So why are you not adjusting for stock options, because they are not in the, it's a non-cash item, so they don't show up in the free cash flow yield. So you are overestimating it, and that's true. But if you take the largest companies in the NASDAQ 100 on an index weight basis, Microsoft, for instance, they have a dilution of 1.9%. So as my point is that even if you took in the dilution for stock options, it wouldn't alter your overall conclusions. But that's actually something I'll be talking about later in my article on analysis.sec. So let's just move on.
All right, Ole, we need to get you in the conversation here. Where is your focus here in these markets? Is it on oil as we're awaiting these, the next numbers in terms of opening up? Or what's your focus? Gold has certainly been languishing badly as we're awaiting the next move in real yields.
Well, we have most certainly seen loss of momentum almost across the board, John. I think probably corn is one of the few exceptions, but we can see that also on slide 14 in the response from hedge funds, because even though there's an overall still bullish sentiment across the market, the fact that prices have been drifting lower and trades sideways, that loss of momentum has led to a reduction in speculative interest over the past month and a half. And we also seen at the same time, the reaction in the price reaction in the market has been relatively small. You can see on the upper, I just put in again on slide 14, one of the ETFs that tracks the Bloomberg Commodity Index, the phenomenal rally from the lows last year. And now we've had a 4 to 5% correction. So not a great deal going on there. And the focusing on two of the big markets, crude oil market remains stuck here in the $60 to $65 range. The market's trying to basically combine the short-term challenge with the longer-term prospects for an improvement, and that's really leading the market to go nowhere in the short term, because we got the coronavirus cases still not under control. In many places, we've seen Peter mentioned India, which is obviously a major consumer, and as long as that is ongoing, then we will continue to backload the expected growth in demand further and further into 2021. And obviously, we're running out of time really in order to fulfill those expectations. And that's why the market is a bit cautious at this point. We're focusing on the OPEC market oil market report today, just following last week's or the pre-Easter announcement that they will start to gradually increase production again over the next 3 months. So we'll see their take on the outlook for global demand. And I just add a slide on gold as well. Not really much going on, because it's clear to see that for now it's probably best just to sit on your hands. We're stuck in a 1680 to 1765 range. We got potential double bottoms and double tops, and when we break that, that will give us quite a clear signal of the next move in the market. Just a final thought on the ETF holdings, which has been going down continuously since January. Actually, no, sorry, since the middle of last year, but especially over the last few months. We did see in March that central bank buying from India and Hungary more than outnumbered the reduction that we saw in ETFs. So that's part of the story, that the reason why we have seen the gold stabilize around this 1700 level now for the past months or so.
All right. And just briefly, want to run through a couple of interesting FX stories. One of those that the U.S. Treasury Department is expected to label Taiwan a currency manipulator. Kind of an interesting move there, given all the geopolitics between the U.S. and China at the moment over Taiwan, and the need for the U.S. to import an awful lot of semiconductors. There was some Taiwanese official that joked that, they can slap imports all they want to on our semiconductors, but they sure as heck do need them still regardless. And you can see why on slide 10. I show you the the dollar Taiwan, although a Taiwanese dollar has accelerated appreciated quite a bit against the dollar since that 2019 the top in the dollar Taiwan rate. You can see the acceleration in the reserve building on that small insert chart on the right in Taiwan, over half a trillion dollars for this rather modest sized country. So it's pretty impressive stuff. And then I stuck on the price chart on the left. I also put in a Chinese yuan versus the Taiwan dollar. You can see how the China allowed its currency to appreciate more rapidly from let's call it mid-2020 onwards. And then in the trend overview, there's nothing new there shaking. And I'm really just curious about something like Aussie dollar. But, the pause button has been pressed for 3+ weeks now, waiting for developments. It looks awfully like it wants to at least try another leg lower, but we need to see that actual technical break and see how the market behaves. And what would bring that about? I'm not quite sure. Some risks, sentiment weakness, perhaps a little bit of consolidation commodities, or fresh U.S. yield rises. And then, of course, we need to cue the incoming inflation data on that. But before we get to that, and I have a couple thoughts on that, you have some comments on NVIDIA. Peter, just want to squeeze that in before we get to the inflation talk.
Yeah, thanks, John. Important news, I would say. So we have NVIDIA out yesterday, basically saying that their Q1 revenue numbers are tracking above expectation. And for the entire fiscal year, they're expecting to be higher than what they have already previously communicated. And we only, one quarter into their new fiscal year there. So it's very strong performance for NVIDIA. The world really want chips, and not the ones you can eat, but the ones you can use to compute everything for Bitcoin mining, crypto mining in general, to autonomous vehicle data centers for all our smartphones. Chips are going in everywhere, all small certain items, the Internet of Things. Just for perspective, NVIDIA's revenue is up 53% over the past year, and this is a company that is already at a $17 billion revenue run rate. And it's just it's just phenomenal. I don't know where this hunger for chips ends, but it's crazy. And then it caused Intel price to be down 4% as well, because part of the announcement of the Q1 results was also that NVIDIA is now aiming to build a new ARM-based. So ARM is this IP company that, you know, make the schematics and designs for computer chips. Then we'll make an ARM CPU again called NVIDIA Grace, specifically targeted data centers. And that's really some of the bread and butter business for Intel. And I know we have one key listener that is working for Intel, and he might give us some color maybe over email or over Twitter, I don't know, hopefully. But it looks like NVIDIA is really setting the stage here. They're promising 10 times performance of today's fastest server. So this is a big deal if that's really true. So this is a story for everyone involved in the semiconductor space that is worth having on the radar.
That's very interesting. And I forgot to actually linking your story slightly back to the Taiwan story. A couple of items there. Talking about chips and the fact that so much of it is, especially the high-end stuff, is produced in Taiwan. Biden out yesterday mentioning strong bipartisan support in Congress for investing more in the U.S. in manufacturing and research in chips to the tune of $50 billion. That was an interesting story. And then also a little bit linked to the whole region is Chinese trade balance in March, only at a surplus of $13.8 billion versus over $50 billion expected. Some of that could be the late Chinese New Year, etc. But that certainly bears watching. And the reason for it was that the import rise was much sharper than the export rise. If commodities continue higher, if the balance starts to tilt towards the import costs rising faster than their export revenues are able to track. But so I just wanted to flag that. And that cues today's really big focus, besides the 30-year auction we mentioned earlier. That is the March CPI. And our chief economist, Stan Yakisman, actually out pointing out an interesting release from the White House, I guess his chief economic advisor, Jared Bernstein, on inflation and the recovery. He said, somewhat odd timing here, isn't it? 2 days before the CPI release. It is expected to 2.5% year on year on the headline. And you can see on slide 16, I compare the year-on-year CPI with the ISM prices paid, which tends to lead it by a few months. So, you know, we could be getting prints in the 4 to 5% range in coming months because of the basing effects of last year's COVID-induced price collapses. And the key will be, of course, beyond that. The Fed is even expecting some transitory rises. But if they are not transitory, we're in a whole different ballgame here. So a lot of anticipation around that. It'd be very interesting to see how the market absorbs a hotter than expected print. And keep in mind, although it's 2.5% year on year, we're also talking about 0.5% month on month. And that is a big, chunky annualized rate there. So that will be the focus. You can see other bits and pieces on the macro calendar on the next slide, on slide 17. And just want to flag finally that we have an RBNZ meeting up overnight. A bit interesting there because they've just recently been handed the mandate to also concentrate on house price stability, and the government has recently moved strongly in tamping down on speculation, and the RBNZ is probably up with some fresh measures as well, macroprudential, to address the housing situation, and this could be a Kiwi negative. So Kiwi traders, watch out for that one overnight. And it's been a long one today, but I think there's a lot of stuff to work through and a lot of interesting things to watch today and as we head into tomorrow. So thanks for joining today, and we'll be back tomorrow with the Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.